I hope everyone is settled. Could I welcome everyone here on behalf of the London School of Economics and Unilever? My name is Anthony Giddens, Director of the LSE. I'm very happy to welcome you all here tonight and, of course, to welcome our very distinguished guest, Mr. Niall Fitzgerald. Mr. Fitzgerald is currently, of course, Chairman of Unilever. He studied at University College Dublin, where he graduated with a degree in commerce. He joined Unilever Ireland in 1967 as an accountant, later becoming chief accountant with Paul and Vincent, the group's animal feeds company. He has been vice chairman of Unilever since 1994, and in September 1996, he succeeded Sir Michael Perry as chairman. Mr. Fitzgerald is chairman of CBI Europe Commerce, has been a non-executive director of the Bank of Ireland since September 1990 and a non-executive director of Prudential Corporation since January 1993. He is a council member of Cooperation Ireland. His former appointments include council member of the Association of Corporate Treasurers, member of the Accounting Standards Review Committee under Sir Ron Deering's chairmanship, someone who in universities we now all know well, or will do shortly, member of the Finance and Industry Committee of the NEDC, and member of the International Policy Council for Agriculture and Trade. Mr. Fitzgerald is going to talk tonight on tomorrow's Europe.
Thank you, Anthony. I'm not sure how I live up to that introduction. Most of those things I'd forgotten I'd ever done, which is probably quite good. Describing the old common market, Walter Hallstein, the Commission's first president, remarked, "Anyone who does not believe in miracles in European affairs is no realist." Now, given the obstacles which lie in the path of further integration, perhaps it's time, I believe, that we all became realists. Walter Hallstein witnessed the miracle of the common market come to fruition. There have been others as part of Europe's evolution. But if the European venture is to go forward, more are now needed. But of course, miracles, as we all know, are usually the result of mere human vision, a bit of planning, a bit of hard work, some sweat, and usually quite a lot of tears. The task of reforming outdated structures which contain self-interested satellites is not a problem which is exclusive to European politicians. Try running a multinational company. And just as Unilever must always plan for the future, so must Europe and its leaders, however awkward, however uncomfortable the future may sometimes look. Certainly Europe must not now go backwards. It cannot afford to. None of us can afford it to happen. The single market, by creating a unified trading base, has enhanced competitiveness and brought immense benefits to every European consumer. Yet despite its impressive successes, the European Union cannot now stand still or take time out. There are fresh challenges within Europe, the task of completing the single market, the issue of enlargement, and of course the much discussed but little understood single currency. At the same time, there are fresh challenges from outside Europe. Competition from emerging markets and evolving regional economic blocs, which themselves seek to gain many of the benefits of scale and scope which they see flowing from Europe's single market. Now then, how do we ensure that tomorrow's Europe succeeds? I intend to devote tonight's lecture to the three economic pillars that together would enhance competitiveness, growth, and employment within the Union. First, there is the single market, which has provided a huge stimulus to competitiveness. It must be completed quickly and enlarged as smoothly as possible. Second, there is the single currency. Set up with the right participants on the right terms and at the right time, the single currency will enhance competitiveness. I will outline my belief in the need, perhaps, for a phased first wave, which offers the opportunity for maximum participation as maximum commitment as well as maximum commitment, and will improve the chances of success. I will also suggest that delay should be contemplated and discussed maturely as a practical necessity if Europe's leaders indeed are to lead rather than to be led by events. And third, I will address the way in which greater labour market flexibility will underpin European competitiveness. Labour market reform is, in my view, a crucial precondition for the single market, for the single currency's success, no less important than adherence to financial criteria. As global change accelerates, European businesses must be adaptable and as quick-footed as our Asian or American competitors. Labour market reform should be part of a reorientated social policy which emphasises not regulation, but employability and competitiveness. If implemented, a new social agenda for Europe will provide the platform from which business can meet the global challenge and beat global competitors. We can very easily get bogged down in difficulties and detail. We should not forget the huge opportunity ahead if we get things right. The horizons of today's young people stretch further than any previous generation. Studying, working, living across the continent now comes naturally to most British kids. So, of course, my argument is based on the assumption that Europe must continue to function as a union of rich diversity, certainly, but a union nevertheless. However vocal its detractors, the European Union cannot be broken up according to petty nationalist concerns. European integration has always served the most pressing global aspiration. In the aftermath of the last war, it forestalled the prospect of future European military conflict. Regionalization is a global response to a changing world. No longer a theory, but a fact in North America, Latin America, and many parts of Asia. And it is there for all to see in successful multinational companies. Unilever sees itself as a multi-local multinational. Like many other international businesses, we have restructured ourselves along regional lines in order to function more effectively in these rapidly coalescing regions. And so, given the global, regional nature of the world economy, it is almost impossible to imagine 15 neighbouring countries all acting according to their own standards, trading practices, and negotiating positions. To imagine such a scenario would be to imagine the 15 separate bodies huddled in their small-time backyards, cowering under the looming shadow of the world's fast-emerging and growing economies, picked off one by one and swallowed whole. For the harsh truth is that on current OECD projections, only Germany and possibly France will feature in the world's top 8 economies within 20 years. First then, the single market. The single market stands as the foundation stone of the new Europe, and its completion is of the utmost importance. It is often forgotten that Britain played a key role in establishing the single market. Much of it was driven through by Lord Cofield, one of our commissioners. If nothing else, this should put an end to the myth that we are destined to forever follow in the slipstream of Germany and France. We have led the way before and can do so again quite frequently. The achievements of the single market have been notable. It has resulted in higher growth and more jobs, as well as enhanced career and business opportunities for some of the brightest and the best in Europe. Companies large and small pay testimony to the importance of the single market. Ian Gibson of Nissan UK has warned that if it wasn't for the single market, French and German consumers would be more likely to buy domestically produced cars. His conclusion is as clear as I have heard. The UK market on its own is too small for survival. At the other end of the scale, take a company like DockSpeed, a small Kent-based company which exports to France, has been able to cut costs and journey times thanks to the removal of barriers. Their turnover has now tripled to over 6 million, They've hired 50 new employees, and I could go on and give you hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of examples, particularly of small companies. Unilever once had factories producing soap in every European country. Now toilet soap for the whole of the continent is produced at our Port Sunlight factory in Merseyside, generating great economies of scale and consumer and environmental benefits. However, this is not the time to rest on our laurels. We will only continue to be successful if we manage to predict and exploit the future areas of growth. The Commission's white paper on growth, competitiveness and employment forecasts massive growth in biotechnology, in telecoms and telecommunications, and environmental technology. Yet worryingly, it is these industries, telecommunications, energy and pharmaceuticals, that the single market has still the furthest to go. Completion, therefore, must be a priority, for it will encourage competition, which in turn will lead to innovation and growth, which we so desperately need. It is essential that Europe concentrate on its strengths, creating wealth while adding value through innovation and the productivity derived from the best technology, itself made possible by the economies of scale of this huge regional market. Fast-moving consumer goods is a European strength. So are media and communications, and the service industries, so often belittled, are another area of strength, delivering high growth and supplying the vast majority of new jobs. What other reforms, therefore, are now required? Unjustified state aids and subsidiaries and subsidies must go. The desire to favour national champions or prop up old industries, especially where a local community is heavily dependent on a single firm. It is understandable, but ultimately counterproductive and doomed to failure. Resources would be better spent on research and technology, transport and communication networks, and training. Leon Britton put it very well when he said, subsidies should equip industry for the future, not lash it to the past. Intellectual property, indirect taxation, recognition of vocational qualifications, and the need for a European company statute all require action. The double taxation of business should be eliminated. Public procurement must be opened up. And as these areas are tackled, whether we like it or not, we must give the Commission, Parliament, and the Court of Justice sufficient power to police the system effectively and make sure what we willed happened happens. The entries of the countries of Central and Eastern Europe to the EU is to be welcomed, not just for the economic opportunities that they bring, but for the democratic advances that membership entails. But they will bring their own competitive challenge. They are potential Euro tigers, ambitious, hard-working, skilled with a low cost base. Their consumers are very demanding, seeking high-quality product at prices they can afford. Businesses looking for growing markets will benefit. The emerging and developing markets of Central and Eastern Europe are a lot closer than China. Unilever, for one, has invested successfully in the Czech and Slovak Republics, Hungary, Romania, Russia, Poland, and see growth now in excess of 20% per annum, year in, year out. Some of our newly built manufacturing plants in this region are amongst the most technologically advanced in the world, yet they can operate at a third of the cost of operating in Germany. An opportunity indeed in our continual quest to meet consumers' exacting demands for quality at ever-improving value for money. Enlargement brings exciting growth markets which Europe's businesses must embrace. The Union itself is not immune to change. That recognition drives the move towards the institutional and voting reforms that will be under discussion at the IGC this weekend. Limited reform of qualified majority voting is vital in a larger union. It would give us a real chance of wider reform. Those who seek an enlarged Europe should recognise that the choice is not between a wider or a deeper Europe. The two go hand in hand. This then is the first foundation for increased competitiveness. The single market must be completed and enlarged swiftly and as smoothly as possible. It is one of the most significant challenges facing the British presidency, which begins in January 1998. I hope the European Council takes up the points in the action plan for the completion of the internal market to be discussed this weekend in Amsterdam. The benefits we reap from the single market will be given even greater and more complete when we move forward quickly and swiftly in the next few months. Government and business has to be ready to contribute ideas, energy, and enthusiasm. They usually do so separately, but in David Simon's case, it is now manifest in one body. He is at the heart of the competitive challenge. David, like many other international business leaders, has long argued the case for closer cooperation in Europe and for a workable single currency. I, like many others, am encouraged to have him there and I wish him well. But his formidable presence does not mean that the rest of business can take a back seat. I now turn to the second pillar of tomorrow's Europe, the single currency. If we have true economic convergence, economic and monetary union should be a logical extension of the single market. Transparent prices would aid competitiveness, and if EMU was set up properly, we could expect inflation and interest rates to be lower. Traders and investors would face a more certain world. Investment, growth, and jobs would all receive a welcome boost. That's on the credit side. However, these alluring benefits will only be realized if convergence is genuine enough to sustain a single, low inflation monetary policy. Starting rates and participants will have to be carefully judged to avoid the political tensions that might in due course tear the currency union apart, and more with it. But it is not just a matter of who enters when and at what exchange rate. Labour market flexibility and fiscal probity will be necessary if the currency union is to be sustainable in the long term. Setting entry conditions is relatively easy. Judging whether or not a country has met these conditions is considerably more difficult. The desire to uphold the criteria must not result in arbitrary decisions taken at a snapshot in time. What matters is underlying and long-term convergence. A country should not be discounted over 0.1% here or there, which equates, after all, to about a morning's output. Far more important is whether they are moving in the right direction and can sustain this movement. These are difficult calls to make, but they shouldn't obscure the vital importance of making the right decisions. Of course, if the euro is set up on the wrong basis, the single currency could be blown apart within a few years, never to be seen again. That would carry great costs. Those now suggesting that there is a case for a soft euro with up to 11 participants are no doubt well-intentioned, but may inadvertently deal the whole EMU project a mortal blow. Economic convergence is a precondition because without it, a single currency cannot be sustained. To seek to drive economies together based solely on political willpower is a recipe for chaos. However, I believe, along I think with the financial markets just now, but they changed by day, that a small core of countries could proceed in 1999. The economies of the so-called first wave core have converged sufficiently to ensure the project's success, and indeed their currencies have been managed on a converged basis for many years. It is essential, however, that politics does not come before economics in deciding the size of the initial group. Countries should not be included, in my view, for sentimental reasons of the good European variety. The true position of the good European is that no country should join until the economic convergence criteria are largely in place. This is not to say that the 1st of January 1999 becomes a literal deadline. If a country is moving solidly towards convergence, then non-participation in the first 24 hours of the single currency should not condemn it to some distant second wave. Such a country should be able to declare its commitment and be invited to join the first wave at a later date. This phased first wave would provide the right economic and political mix to ensure lasting success. In this scenario, the real core would not be just the first countries to sign up, but also their fellow first phase waivers, who would be likely to join them within 3 years. We must, in my view, eliminate the macho need to be seen to be part of the first wave at 1 minute past midnight on January 1999. So what should Britain do? First and foremost, Britain must engage fully in the discussions. For even if Britain decides to state it will never join a single currency, the success of such a currency across much of our home market will be crucial to British business. It is directly in Britain's interest to make sure that a single currency is set up on the right basis. Moreover, I take it as axiomatic that at some point Britain would want to join a successful single currency. It could still be that Britain might decide to participate in the first wave, but the ERM condition, bar the ERM condition, it will certainly fulfil the convergence criteria handsomely, thanks to Ken Clark and now Gordon Brown. Some will be tempted to argue that Britain should continue a wait-and-see policy, that we should wish the project well, but do not get committed before we see whether it works. Such a policy could, in my view, be disastrous. It would repeat the mistake Britain has so often made in its relations with Europe. In 1956, when the Treaty of Rome was signed, in the 1960s, when the Common Agricultural Policy took shape, and in 1978, when the exchange rate mechanism was set up. On each of these occasions, we stood on the sidelines and missed the opportunity to shape events in our national interest. Let's learn the lesson and participate rather than spectate. Business will play a role in the debate, not as blind Europhiles, but as players with a legitimate interest and insight. The Confederation of British Industry will be setting out the arguments clearly and without prejudice. But other parties have been strangely silent. In particular, I'm thinking of the City of London. The occupants of the Square Mile have much to gain in the long term from a successfully launched and sustainable EMU. Yet the city has, for the most part, been remarkably quiet on the issue. Abstention is a dangerous thing. Does the city really believe that the powerhouses of New York, Tokyo, and let's just say Frankfurt, will continue to regard London as focal to their operations if the British economy is peripheral to mainstream Europe? Will Britain not be consigned to some sort of offshore role, picking up the crumbs from the rich men's table? And think not just of the prospect of decline, but the missed opportunities for growth and success. The chairman of BMW sounded his own personal warning earlier this year that if the single currency proceeded without Britain, the financial capital of Europe will be Frankfurt, not London. Who knows? But it must be a possibility. It is certainly time for the city to enter the debate. We need to hear the sound of bankers leaping off fences. There might be a legitimate economic argument against Britain joining the first wave immediately. We have higher interest rates than the continent because we are at a more advanced point in the economic cycle, and inflationary pressures are stronger here in Britain. In these circumstances, I believe that we should give an unequivocal commitment to go in at a later stage, on a clear timetable. This would allow us to continue to influence discussions and make our own internal policy preparations. In this scenario, we will enjoy the benefits of a successful single currency as speedily as is practicable from a British point of view. One final word, if I may, to those who claim that delay to the start of EMU would be death. Momentum, once interrupted, would be lost forever. This is in danger of becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy. Surely, Europe's political leaders wish to drive events and not be driven by them. Surely, they have sufficient self-confidence to decide, if necessary, on a later, controlled start, if that is what is essential to ensure sustained success. A pragmatic British voice with credibility and authority restored through its clear commitment to the success of EMU is now essential in the crucial months ahead. Better this than some eccentric appeal to speculators to take control. This brings me to the third pillar of tomorrow's Europe, labour market flexibility. There are many fascinating questions which surround the issue of the single currency, but surely one of the most important is whether Europe can make its labour markets more flexible. Without that flexibility, employment will suffer and political support for economic and monetary union will be fatally undermined. With this scenario in mind, let me explain the philosophy of flexibility and why I believe it is right. Then I would like to set out why I believe the time is ripe for Britain to take a lead. And finally, to suggest that what the agenda of action should be, a new social agenda for Europe that should guide the actions of companies, member states, and the Union itself. What then do I mean by flexibility? Well, let me start by saying what it shouldn't mean. Flexibility should emphatically not be management speak for lower wages and a return to 19th century working conditions. It is only proper that there be a minimum set of rights for working people, unless, that is, we see sustainable economic advantage from sending 10-year-old boys down chimneys. Good companies already protect their employees and pay them well, but it is not unknown for less scrupulous businesses to use employer power to exploit workers, and because it is entirely legitimate for the state to adopt measures to protect people at work. So what does flexibility mean? It means flexible working patterns, the ready availability of workers with the right skills, and crucially, a less rigid labour market with lower social costs and less regulation that enables the rapid response to continuous change. Businessmen and women can then take on the people they need as opportunities arise, and in turn, people have the mobility, adaptability, and the skills to grasp new opportunities. Businesses will succeed if they can adopt as fast as moving consumer tastes, keeping up with new technology and productivity. But if these same businesses are overburdened by regulation and costs, then they won't be able to create the new jobs. However, in the insecure hire and fire culture of the worst US businesses, that is socially undesirable, and it is economically unsuccessful. In a world where success depends on a company's ability to adapt, highly skilled and well-motivated employees are crucial. The training and team building necessary for innovation cannot happen without some measure of security and stability, nor would it be in employers' interests to invest. For this reason, the long tradition of social responsibility and consensus shown by continental European companies is valuable. The danger occurs when security turns into rigidity, creating a security that is nothing more than an illusion. If companies cannot change according to new conditions, then they will fail. The challenge then is not to choose between two antagonistic models, the Anglo-American versus the European, but to realize that tomorrow's Europe must learn from both. The European Commission's Competitiveness Advisory Group, on which Flores Malias, one of my predecessors, and David Simon sat, put it simply. We need to encourage mobility, positive flexibility and change in the labour market, avoid rigidities which become disincentives to work and take on new employees. So why is the time ripe for Britain to take a lead in this vision of flexibility. Britain's new government has a tremendous opportunity starting at Amsterdam. The Prime Minister has stated his intention to sign both the new employment chapter and end the British opt-out from the social chapter. Neither of these proposals is much loved by British business. However, Tony Blair has a real chance to turn what some see as a threat, however mild, into a positive opportunity. If Britain says yes to the employment chapter, it must include proper acknowledgement of the need for flexibility and real labour market reforms in the many member states. And when Britain signs up for the social chapter, it should insist on the adoption of a new social agenda. Though we should remember that, despite all the hullabaloo, only two measures have been adopted using the social chapter in the last 5 years, parental leave and European Works Councils, which suggests that the social chapter is unjustly being used as a proxy for many other undesirable continental social habits. Nonetheless, I hope that the socialist victory in France will not give credence to those who claim a whole raft of new regulations is a brewing. What better way to do this than to require the Commission and the Presidency to come up with an urgent action program to reform the European social model. We must remove the labour market rigidities that are barriers to new jobs and promote increased employability instead. To this end, I was delighted to hear Mr. Blair's comments at the recent mini-summit in Noordwijk, in which he said that Labour will not allow the social chapter to be used to introduce legislation that could damage British competitiveness. Also, his recent address to the European Socialist Congress was encouraging in its focus on a new realism in social policy. But Britain is not alone. There are numerous examples of change across Europe in areas that are decided nationally, not by the Union. For example, Germany has made changes to sick pay entitlements, and in the Netherlands, unemployment has fallen to half its level of the early 1980s. A Goldman Sachs study there shows how employers' social security contributions have been cut, part-time working made easier, and bottom-end marginal taxes reduced. Reforms, I might add, that are directly related to the Dutch decision to allow the guilder to shadow the Deutschmark as a precursor to monetary union. But there is a long way to go. Spain knows that its rigid labour laws, which have contributed to a quarter of the workforce being unemployed, cannot survive EMU. And in Italy, where non-wage costs on employers are 44%, even the brave attempts at reform by my ex-Unilever board colleague, Romano Prodi, are seen as too little and too slow. Let me give you a practical illustration of what must change. In many member states, there is a cumbersome and costly procedure that must be followed if a company wants to close a plant. In principle, employees should be consulted, but the current requirements go much too far. In France, regrettable but necessary decisions to close plants lead to court cases and unnecessarily long delays, sometimes extending over many years, as we have experienced in our own plants. We would prefer to spend that time working with staff to help them find alternative work and offering advice and help on retraining, something we did when we closed our Cairn Mills plant in the UK, and by the time the plant closed, only a handful of people remained to be placed. That is a positive social agenda. It is crucial to recognise that the rigidities exist for the most part at the national level. The move to a single currency has impelled nation states to tackle these problems. It could be said that the monetarist prescriptions that Mrs. Thatcher urged on Britain are being forced on the rest of the continent by the discipline of economic and monetary union. I find it a delicious, ironic twist that many of those passionately opposed to EMU are of a Thatcherite persuasion. They should recognise that the dynamics of the single market and the single currency are working to break down the worst rigidities and over-regulation of the old European model, not build them up. Given this situation, what is the agenda of action Europe needs to put in place? I'm not saying that there should not, and indeed will not, be a push for improved social standards in the future. But employee security must be based on increasing employability rather than on the illusory security drawn from rigid workplace protections. The former aids competitiveness. The latter puts it at risk. We must move from regulation towards benchmarking and promoting best practice. Plenty of work has been done on this. We must now apply it. Each year, at least 10% of jobs disappear and are replaced by new, different jobs. These, in return, require new and different skills. Government and EU initiatives must work with that reality. And it is here that a crucial element of our success lies. And there's even a name for it, Flexibility Plus. Europe must have a better trained and a more adaptable workforce. It is incongruous that even with current levels of high unemployment, companies report difficulties in filling positions. Flexibility plus skills. By this I mean not just training for one particular type of work, but the core skills necessary to adapt to new work demands. Communications and organisational skills, interpersonal skills, the ability to work in a team and to take responsibility, as well, of course, as the three R's. This skilling up cannot stop at 18 or 21, or even in some cases at 16. It must be ongoing throughout an individual's working life, and it must embrace people at all levels of attainment. The development of an underclass, unskilled, and unused to the world of work is not just morally unacceptable, it is also hugely costly to the public purse and bad for business. A growing army of unskilled, illiterate, uninvolved, embittered communities with no stake in society or the economy can neither buy the products we offer nor play a part in expanding the production of these products. To allow such an underclass to continue unaddressed is destructive and a damning indictment of our claims to be a civilized society. It should be made easier to join the educational flow at any level and at any age. Companies should do their bit. After all, it is in their direct interest to do so. Initiatives like Investors in People should be showcased across member states, and we should research what our partners can teach us. Work done by academics in the Leverhulme Trust has demonstrated clearly the importance of lifelong learning. Those European countries which have provided high levels of education and training to the unskilled and given them the chance to climb up the labour market ladder so they are not condemned to unemployment or dead-end jobs with poverty pay. Alongside this new flexibility, we need to make one further change, a change harder than adapting or adopting a new policy. We need a new mindset for Europe. For if labour markets are more flexible and workers more skilled, the final ingredient is the entrepreneurial spirit to create the value with these. The entrepreneur is crucial. It is one of the most startling differences between the economic culture of Southeast Asia and the US on one hand, and Europe on the other. In Southeast Asia and the US, the risk taker, the business builder are valued, and these are the people who create opportunities, the opportunities which flexible labor markets can respond to meet. A successful entrepreneur or business leader is also allowed to retain a reasonable amount of the fruits of his or her enterprise. He or she is admired, not envied. We need to remember that the vast majority of European employees don't work in the Unilevers or the Siemens of this world. Only 1/3 of private sector employees work in companies employing more than 250 people. Another third in the classic small business of 10 to 250 employees, And surprisingly, a surprisingly large third in companies with staff of less than 10 people. My Dutch co-chairman, Maurice de Backslet, recently presided over a European round table inquiry into the relationship between large and small companies. Its report argues that there is great potential for creating jobs through mutually beneficial partnerships between large and small businesses. Large companies can help SMEs to set up and grow by sharing their considerable experience through mentoring schemes. In returns, SMEs bring a breath of fresh air to large businesses to help them respond nimbly, for example, in the development and marketing of R&D projects. The ERT report also reflects concerns at the social costs small businesses face. Lack of flexibility affects smaller companies more acutely. They find red tape and overregulation more costly than bigger businesses. The Competitiveness Advisory Group estimates a burden of 3,500 EQ per employee in a small company compares to 600 EQ per employee in a larger company. In the future, most of our new jobs will be in SMEs. Admittedly, as the study shows, via their symbiotic relationship with larger companies on whom they depend. Brussels must take note of these points. We must realise that this shift to smaller businesses affects how we train our workforce. In the past, the big company in the jobs for life culture took responsibility. That can no longer be sustained. They cannot guarantee lifetime employment, but they can help to develop lifetime employability. Individuals must be encouraged to take responsibility for themselves. A growing private sector for training, a competitive marketplace for vocational training, would revolutionise what is available. Companies and individuals need tailored professional advice. Support from trade bodies and government agencies is not enough. At present, it is those advising on financial capital who are integral to a company's future planning. In tomorrow's Europe, they must be joined by the training advisors and providers. In my company, it is not lack of financial capital that is seen as a constraint on our growth, but a lack of skilled human capital. To achieve labour market flexibility, we need a new social approach in both Brussels and the Member States. That new approach needs to make a start this weekend in Amsterdam. Britain's signature of the social chapter should herald not just a change of policy on the part of the British government, but the adoption of a new agenda throughout the Union in which the whole question of social costs and labour market rigidities is looked at anew. This must be reflected in the text of the new employment chapter as well. Britain's new government has given a stimulus to thinking across member states and freed people from some of the stale posturing of recent times. Europe is genuinely galvanised, and it is an opportunity we must not pass up. The required direction is clear. The emphasis must change from increased regulation to increased flexibility and employability, to achieving change through the promotion of success, not through an increase in regulation. The best businesses operate on the principles of flat hierarchies and good communications. Too often it seems that the union imposes increasing layers of regulations. They must be stripped away. The principles guiding the new social agenda should be clarity of function, no overlapping, and true subsidiarity. In short, do things only once at the most appropriate level, or as we seek to do in any business, at the level where it best adds value. But this is not to say that there is no scope for European initiatives. It is my view that there are areas where action on a European level can secure greater opportunities for all parties. I would like to see some of the following ideas explored: ensuring a liberal, Europe-wide framework of labour law and regulation specifically for small businesses, the refocusing of structural funds on people rather than physical infrastructure, a greater role for private capital in enhancing infrastructure, the benchmarking of competitive best practice across the EU to the establishment of multinational task forces, the promotion of best practice in training, including in particular an EU push to promote language skills and pension reforms so that people can move their pension entitlement with them, and the growth of properly funded pensions is both encouraged and facilitated. I would like to see more encouragement for more pan-European research projects of practical application to business competitiveness, greater emphasis on building trans-European transport and information networks, and the determination to fully utilise the potential of new information media such as the internet. Now, I do not claim to put before you a fully worked out set of proposals, nor do I even claim it great originality. But what is needed is fresh thinking to direct the Union onto a new agenda. These ideas are a modest personal contribution to a very necessary and overdue debate. Making this case and changing our agenda on social Europe in favour of flexibility, learning and enterprise will not be easy. So let me repeat to you the foundations I have described for a more competitive Europe: a completed single market, a successful single currency, and more flexible labour markets with the emphasis clearly and directly on better skills and adaptability. And today, a British government with a new authority can lead on all three. They can make completion of the single market the hallmark of the British presidency. They can make commitment to the principle of the single currency the basis for leading the shaping of a sustainable EMU. And they can use their political credibility to drive for a new social agenda which will enhance competitiveness and bring Europeans back to work. Europe must not go backwards. A new mindset must move us all forwards. Today, I painted a picture of what Europe could be like if we all played our part. If we stand aside, we damage ourselves. Europe needs a dynamic, the dynamic of our own successful experience. To be at the heart of Europe means contributing ideas, insights, and experience. Let us be ourselves, not complaining on the periphery, but active in the centre. Europe will move and change and grow. It is time to fashion our vision for tomorrow's Europe. For tomorrow's Europe must be our Europe. There is no time left to wait and see. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for that lecture, delivered with some passion, I should say. Could I just mention, we do have space for questions. There is a reception, however, a little later in the common room through there. The acoustics of this room are not very good, especially from side to side. So at least I make a plea if people are bold enough for anyone who is asking questions to come to the front, and I'll give them this microphone. I think we can afford about a quarter of an hour at least for questions and answers. But someone has to start.
Charles Grant from The Economist and the Centre for European Reform. I'd like to ask a very quick question about EMU. To what extent does a successful single currency require the coordination or harmonisation of fiscal policy, or indeed other measures in the direction of a political union?
I don't think it needs it to begin with. I think as it proceeds, and if it is seen to work, then I think some degree of fiscal harmonisation may well be necessary. But I underline harmonisation. It isn't central fiscal control. It is a degree of consistency, at least, in what happens across the Union. I do not see that ultimately leading necessarily to a firmer form of political union. I think that has to be, that is and has to be the subject of separate views, separate discussions. And I certainly don't see that it follows one from the other. The single currency for me, from the very moment I began to try to grapple with what it was and what it meant and what it might mean, it started for me from, is it likely to help the further integration of the single market? Is it likely to lead to improved competitiveness? Because if it didn't, and if I wasn't persuaded that it would, then my vote would be the first vote against the single currency. I am convinced that it does, if done properly, and it will bring the single market onto the next stage, which will further enhance European competitiveness.
I think
Nicola Pignatelli, advisor to Merck. Well, I'll speak a little bit as an Italian at this point. You suggested, in a way, the variable geometry for or the various timing for the entrance and participation in a single currency. Now, I used to think the same way, but I've begun to change my mind. Now, the Italian economy is number three, I think, in Europe. But in terms of industrial content, manufacturing content, is number two behind Germany. 35% of our GDP is produced by manufacturing. Second, the trade surplus is the second largest in Europe because of that, I suppose. In the last 3 years and consistently in the last 12 months. Now, how can you, and the third point is that the biggest burden on the deficit is represented by the high cost of money. And there is debate to be in. It's a macho debate for politicians, but it's a practical debate because once you get in, your burden goes down and therefore you are in line with the parameters. So I think that since the Protocol of Maastricht did not set rigid parameters but trending parameters, why exclude one or two or three countries which are not too far away from the main pack?
I really don't want to get into a discussion on individual countries, particularly as an Irishman. That would be particularly invidious. But as a generalized statement, I think what I said was that I don't believe that there should be a rigid, the criteria is X, you're not at X, therefore you're not in. The point I tried to make was that what was most important was whether directionally you were going in the right place and whether that was likely to be sustained. And I think that is the issue which is going to cause the most head-scratching now. Not will they be close, are they committed to doing so? I don't just mean Italy, I mean several countries. But are they going to be able to sustain it? And are they going to be able to sustain it against the background of very, in some cases, serious social pressures? And that's why I link the financial criteria with the labour market flexibility issue. Because there is no example of anywhere which is governed by one currency which doesn't have within it the ability for resource to follow around from part to part, and which is flexible enough and which can be mobile enough. And I think to overlook or to put as a secondary point the issue of continuing to press for labour market flexibility and simply assume that it can all be put together based on financial criteria, which, bear in mind, in Maastricht in 1991, these were seen as hugely important. Now, day after day, they become less and less important by the same people. Which is not to say they've changed, but as they've learned more as they've gone along. But they're only one part of the equation, and I think it would be, even if you are the most passionate believer in EMU, for whatever reason, you should, in my view, be worried about an EMU which is put together with economies which are not convergent and not likely to be able to sustain that convergence, because in a very short time, a matter of a few years, that single currency would blow apart and you would not see it again in the generations of any of us in this room, I think. So I think you have to be concerned about it in that score.
My name is David Lee from the TUC. As Niall knows, we're very much on his line about the EMU. But on the question of the labour market, I don't think the balance is quite right. In the new flexible labour markets, we are creating, for example, many, many millions of part-time workers. Now, last week in Brussels, and it was ratified, then signed in The Hague, in the presence of Wim Kok, the Dutch Prime Minister, and Ad Melkert, the Dutch Minister of Social Affairs, and Jacques Santer, we made this agreement with the employers at European level on part-time workers. Now, this flexibly gives the right, for example, of German employers to employ people on a part-time basis, which they've not quite had before, and that's why the German unions were against it. But for the many millions of workers who are working part-time, they also need equivalent rights, because how are these people going to live if this is the new flexible labour market with many millions of part-time workers? So I just make a point of information that the third element now in the social chapter will in the autumn undoubtedly become the part-time workers. And also, I think a little more recognition of the role of the social partners, which may not be so fashionable in this room as in some other places, is worth a mention. It was we in the TUC who wrote the first draft of the draft directive on the transferability of pensions. Now you mentioned at the end the transferability of pensions. We persuaded the DGB and in turn the German Labour Ministry to change the vesting period philosophy in the German pensions industry, which is quite a step forward. So I think some recognition in line with signing the social chapter and the employment chapter of some of the philosophy that lies behind it, and there should be less of an antithesis between, I don't know, the dinosaur social chapter image that's sometimes created and the actual work that's done under it.
I'm not sure, David, if that was a question or just a correction of what I said. But let me take the opportunity to answer two of the questions that were within it, I think. Firstly, I don't think there's any difference at all between us on the issue of part-time. I mean, I think the changes which were made last week, or which were endorsed last week, to give part-time workers the same terms and conditions as full-time workers, is entirely in line with the move to flexibility, because we all want to have the flexibility to use more part-time workers. And therefore, it is appropriate that they have the same conditions as full-time workers, because then more people will be prepared to be and willing to be part-time workers. So I think I see no inconsistency at all in that. I think as far as the social chapter is concerned, I mean, I said it tonight and I'll repeat it again, the social chapter has so far only done two things. It's introduced under the social chapter, it's parental leave and European Works Councils. And all of the undesirable social costs and rigidities that are often referred to and which exist have been introduced under national legislation and can be eliminated under national legislation. As long as, what's now important, and that's the point I was trying to make, I hope rather forcibly, that in signing the social chapter, or not signing it, but giving up its opt-out, Britain has an opportunity to then take the initiative and to lead and make the social chapter encompass a new social agenda which picks up many of the issues which need to be addressed if we are going to become more competitive. Because even though there have been great advances in recent years, the European economy as such is not competitive on a global scale. It needs to be. And if it isn't, we won't have the additional employment which we all want. And we'll look at more and more people out of work. Unless we start with how do we find a way to make the economies and the regional economy, which is Europe, more competitive on a global scale.
William Wallace, LSC. I just want to ask why there were three themes and not a fourth. You had as a sub-theme the whole question of enlargement. That does seem to me to be key to the future of the European market. You talk about it only in terms of the single market. There were 100 million consumers out there. Investment, including yours, is flowing in that direction. Poland was last year the fastest growing economy in Europe. If you see that as an important part of tomorrow's Europe, I would encourage you as businessmen to push the deeply reluctant governments which see the costs but don't see the benefits, to push that much further up your agenda, because it might encourage our governments to push it a little further up their agenda.
That's a perfectly fair point. Certainly if I speak for my own company, we are very committed to it. We had no business in Central and Eastern Europe 5 years ago. Today we have a £1 billion business. So we have literally put our money where our mouth is. I didn't include as a fourth, I think probably just thinking of the patience of the audience. If I'd gone on to a fourth, God knows how long we'd have been here, and I'd probably have lost half the audience. I do see it as being an actual outcome of the continuing progression of the single market. It is enlarging the single market. I don't think, in principle, there's any great reluctance out there, and certainly not any of the politicians that I have spoken to. I think there is a genuine, understandable concern about the pace at which people can be absorbed. And there is, of course, one great ticking time bomb, which is that it is not possible to contemplate enlargement without fundamentally changing the common agricultural policy, which nobody is yet really prepared to put on the table. They put on the table, but not with any suggestions to how it could be done.
I think in order to enhance flexibility, I'll just take two more questions. Perhaps they could be fairly short. I think there's over the back there.
Walter Eltis, Oxford University. When you said that if countries that haven't truly converged are admitted to EMU, then the thing will break down, are you agreeing with Martin Taylor's recent statement that speculators would have the power to destroy the exchange rate structure if economies which haven't converged are allowed to join?
I don't want to engage in a proxy battle with Martin Taylor. I think that if he was reported correctly, and of course one always suffers from not being reported correctly, but if he was, and if he actually said what was reported, that he urged speculators to do it, then I think that was not a very responsible, constructive piece of advice. On the other hand, if what he was saying was that unless there is real convergence. And again, let's bear in mind what we're talking about, real convergence. It's not everybody is below 3 and everybody is below 60 and everybody is right of the right fractions. It is whether the direction is right and whether it is judged that those who are moving in that direction can do it sustainably over time. That is my definition of convergence. Then I think you will have something which would be difficult, not impossible of course, but difficult for speculators to break apart. On the other hand, if you have such a widespread fudge between economies which are obviously not converging and not likely to converge for some time, then you're simply handing the speculators a quick profit. And whether Martin Taylor was saying they should do it or simply predicting it, one way or another, it will come true.
Alan Watson, Burst Marsteller, Europe. I think many people will have found your address, Niall, or as the BBC insists on calling you, Neil, very refreshing. And we all look forward to hearing the sound of bankers falling off fences. What about industrialists falling off fences? You have, of course, made your position clear and even clearer tonight. David Simon, when he was chairman of BP, did the same. But the Institute of Directors continues pretty overwhelmingly to be opposed to not just the single currency, but really further integration of the European Union. And the CBI has been somewhat ambiguous. And I wonder if you look forward to greater clarity and greater support from the business community.
Let me take the second part of the question first, Alan. The CBI is on current plan, will make its recommendation to the government crystal clear on the 22nd of July. That is when the CBI Council meets, and assuming the Council agrees what's put before them, and they may not, but assuming they do, then there will be a very clear recommendation from the CBI, which will have a broad consensus of support within the CBI. I can't comment on the Institute of Directors. The Institute of Directors seems to me as a sort of club of individuals rather than representing individuals or businesses as such, but individuals can speak for themselves. I think quite often, all of us as business people, I mean, we have businesses to run, and we're very hesitant sometimes to get up and engage in what can be construed to be a political debate. I don't know, I've lost count of the number of times I've been accused on this particular topic of meddling in politics.
Well, I'm not meddling in politics. What I'm doing is stating my view of what is necessary for what I believe is necessary for business to prosper in Europe. And I'm paid by my shareholders to make sure that my company views both are heard and that we do as much as we can to create the right circumstances for that business to prosper. So that's not politics for me, that's straightforward business and economics. However, having said that, it's not unknown, even when you try to steer a very careful line in terms of making clear you're speaking as a businessman, for your views to be sort of misused, misconstrued, and entirely hijacked sometimes. And that probably explains why many businessmen, including myself, I'd have to say, for the period of the election campaign, kept extremely quiet on the subject. And why I think now that that's out of the way, you'll find more and more people beginning to speak their minds.
Well, there are lots more people who want to ask questions, but I feel we have to move to a close. Can I invite you again to join us at the reception and thank our speaker very, very much indeed.